Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Pia Mancini from Open Collective and Democracy Earth. How are you?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm great. I'm very excited to talk to you today because I'm hearing more and more from my friends, from my community about Open Collective and how exciting it is for people doing open source projects. So I started digging around and trying to learn more about you, your background, and the kinds of things that you've been involved in. And it sounds like you have a very deep interest in democracy as a concept.
Indeed, and most of my career has been revolved around democracy and politics. So that's my background, that's where I come from, and that's certainly where my interest lies.
Where did that start? Were you a child always interested in 10 years old in democracy, or when did this start?
That is actually true. I've always been interested in politics. Like, my house was a house where we would fight for over the newspaper in the morning, and politics was always part of the conversation. So I was always interested in democracy and institutions in general and how they affect us. And I've worked in politics most of my life, from sort of every aspect of it, from think tanks to campaigning to running for office myself to working for government. So it's been quite a challenging ride.
Did you always agree with your parents and your family as you argued, or how did you develop your own perspective, or did you adopt theirs?
Well, my family has like a very political history. We from very different ideological viewpoints, so it's hard to agree with. It was always hard to agree with everyone and to fight with everyone. So I think that I've been kind of molded in a way by those conversations, but definitely. Well, it depends on the period of my life. I was more combative, if you want, in my teenage years. And I definitely wouldn't see eye to eye with my father in most of the conversations. but I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to pick what's ideology and what's just growing up, right?
What is liquid democracy?
So liquid democracy is it's an understanding of democracy that kind of removes the territorial basis for legitimacy and power. Essentially, the way our institutions are structured, our political system is structured today, revolves around the territory. And we are represented by people, professional citizens that we call politicians, or representatives. And we are represented because of the place that we happen to be living at, or worse, where we were born at. And liquid democracy proposes to flip that equation and say that we can actually be represented by anyone. There's no reason why I can only be represented by Argentina or Argentinian representatives. I'd rather be maybe represented by, I don't know, say on climate change, by Costa Rica, or a group of like-minded individuals, or a city that is extremely progressive in their energy policies. But we are kind of stuck to the territorial basis for political organizations because that's what we've inherited. Because at the time that our political institutions were designed, the best communication technology at the time was the post, the mail. And so there wasn't really a lot more that they could design. But that obviously the internet changed that, and our political institutions did not change with times. And so what we propose is a system that where we can allocate our power, our decision to different people for different topics, regardless of where we're living at or where we were born. So as a concept of liquid democracy. So we flip the idea of representation from a vertical territorial notion of representation where we essentially outsource our decision making to a group of people for 4 years or 2 years or 6 years, mm-hmm. But for very long periods of time that they decide on our behalf on all topics, which in my mind is just, it really blows my mind. And the idea of liquid democracy is that we can, anyone can be our representatives. We can allocate that. We can trust different people for different topics so they have different expertise or different experiences, regardless of where they are.
That's really interesting. The way that you phrase it kind of does make it a little bit disturbing that we would pick one individual or two individuals from our state and then give them authority over all topics, even if they have zero expertise in that topic.
Right. Which is essentially what we do.
Yeah.
And I think that what we're seeing today, in terms of kind of the turmoil that we're seeing in many democracies has to do a little bit with this, has to do with a model that is not able to respond to the preferences of citizens that have preferences that go beyond the territory. And at the same time, it's not able to update itself. And so there's this, at least in my mind, I'm seeing this kind of situation where our government is very out of sync with who we are and how we act. And so we are stuck with these institutions that we inherited. But my argument is that, is that we're not bound to them. We own them. And so we can, and I think it's our responsibility, not only that we can, I think we should, redesign them and rethink them with the current technology that we have and with the current, set of values and beliefs and, an economic settings that we have today. Like, institutions are not created in the void. They respond to a certain period, a certain education, a certain economic model, a certain technology existing at one point in time. And when all of that changes, we must update our institutions.
It seems like it's the updating of institutions or the stopping the inertia of any number of historical documents that I think at least folks in America, because I can only speak as an American, get uncomfortable with, whether it be something that was, stone tablets that were several thousand years ago, or whether they were a piece of parchment from a couple hundred years ago. They feel that certain things should be sacrosanct and permanent. So the idea of updating something, whether it be because the internet or whatever, scares people.
Yeah, and look, it makes sense. And I think it's not a process that we should take lightly. But I think that innovation needs to take place in these spaces. And mm-hmm. It's very difficult for the status quo to innovate because it's against their nature, right? Like, power is conservative by nature. It wants to stay in power. So expecting the center, expecting the status quo, the establishment to innovate, it's futile because it's simply not in their interest. Like, their preferences it's always going to be to hold on to power. So that's how the system is designed. So mm-hmm. I think that there's, what's interesting about exploring these options in the fringes is that innovation is less expensive in the fringes. And so it's easier to propose kind of radical ideas and start testing them in kind of sandboxes, right? And then, mm-hmm. And then eventually those sandboxes are going to get bigger, or those ideas are going to get more mainstream, and eventually we're going to end up updating our political system. I'm an optimist. That might be a virtue or a flaw, but I am an optimist, and I think that if we want to kind of push the boundaries of what it's doable, we need to start sort of building alternative models, and we need to start sort of moving the perception of what is doable.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about sandboxes. So people who are listening to this podcast might wonder how we started the first few sentences about open source, and then suddenly we're off talking politics. Perhaps someone is 9 minutes into this podcast and they're already going to stop listening because we've said something that they don't agree with. But you make a really interesting point on the website democracy.earth. .earth is the top level domain. You say, we are 21st century citizens interacting with 19th century institutions based on 15th century information technology. What is Democracy Earth? And talk to me about sandboxes rather than from a country perspective, but from a small or medium sized organizational perspective.
Right. So, I mean, Democracy Earth, what it tries to do is to see the internet as a political jurisdiction and think about how we can leverage existing technologies like blockchain, for example, to distribute votes among different people. So mm-hmm. one concrete example that we did, one sandbox, is when the referendum for peace in Colombia took place, mm-hmm. You could only vote. So a couple of things happened. The first one is that referendums, what they do is they turn complex issues into a binary decision, right? Mm. And so what happened with the referendum in Colombia is that like a very complex and comprehensive agreement got boiled down to, do you want the FARC, that's the sort of the guerrilla forces, mm-hmm. to have a role in the Colombian political life, yes or no? That was pretty much it, right? And so the consequence of doing that was that was the issue that the whole piece sort of hanged on. And so it got, it wasn't approved, right? The peace agreement was revoked by the referendum. Mm-hmm. So what we set out to do before all of this happened was, open up a space where we could vote, not in a single issue, but we could we sort of divided the referendum into different clauses and we invited people to vote on those different clauses. And from all of the clauses, the first five got approved by a landslide. And just the one from the FARC got rejected by a landslide. So that was clearly the issue, right? But almost all of the agreement could have passed if we would have done something where, you know, a much more comprehensive voting scenario. And the second thing that happened in Colombia was that the diaspora wasn't allowed to vote.
Interesting.
Only the people in Colombia could vote. And we found that very unfair. Why do we expect still in the 21st century for citizens to physically go to a place in order to give them a voice in the world? So we wanted to give a space for the diaspora to vote. So this is the kind of sandbox project that I'm talking about. Grabbing issues that where we can start experimenting and piloting with these kind of liquid democracy arrangements. Because obviously, as with any innovation, we need to test and experiment. We don't have the institutions that we have because they were built in a day. Like we grew to have them here, and they developed into what they are now. And so every time we talk about updating our institutions, I have the feeling that there's this expectation of, well, what are you going to bring up tomorrow that's going to be great, right? Mm-hmm. And so our sort of more humble path is like, we're going to be experimenting with these institutions because the only way to learn is by doing. Yeah, that's sort of one example. Another example of sandboxes is with climate change, for example. Climate change is an issue that it's very clear that it doesn't have to be territorial. It doesn't make sense that only nation states mm-hmm. are invited to the table. Mm. So that's the kind of experiments that we're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that from a technology perspective, the parts that I think are very interesting are the use of the blockchain as an accounting system to be incorruptible, so that transactions cannot be removed. You know, it's kind of write only and append only. And then another one that is interesting around liquid democracy is the idea of this binary vote, like you say, is so simplistic. Why not make it more like, for lack of a better word, user voice, where someone gets 100 votes and then they can vote on different pieces depending on how strongly they feel about something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But when they've done that, they've then removed their votes from something else. So if I am a single issue voter, that's fine. But then I can't, I get less of an opinion on another issue that maybe I have less interest in.
Yeah. So we can make sort of much more sophisticated arrangements today using technology. And as you say, look, I'm from Argentina, and I come from a country where ballot boxes are still stolen and burned after elections. Mm. And so having something like the blockchain, that, as you say, it's an incorruptible ledger, I think that's the most attractive thing. So having storing votes and decisions on a tool like that, it's extremely powerful, especially from someone coming from, you know, Latin America or countries where, you know, the sanctity of the vote is not exactly respected.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this software is open source and it is a nonprofit. People can donate. People can learn about Democracy Earth. How does it relate to Open Collective? Are they different sides of the same coin? Are they on a vector? How do those two organizations relate to each other?
Well, I'm kind of the connector at the moment. Mm-hmm. So I was one of the founders of Democracy Earth. And Democracy Earth is like an evolution of many years of doing politics in Argentina. Mm-hmm. And when we started, we built a political party called the Net Party to run for elections for Congress, and with this idea that we would only vote according to what citizens decided on a platform that was at the time called Democracy OS, that it still exists. Mm-hmm. And so the idea was to, again, flip that mandate and say, what we're doing is bringing into Congress the voices of thousands of citizens who want to participate, but because the way the system is designed, they're sort of left, you know, they're reduced to being recipients of a monologue, being able to cast a vote every couple of years, and that's about all the input that the system accepts from them. Mm-hmm. When we did the Net Party, it took us such a long time to have our political party approved, because again, it was like asking permission for the status quo to disrupt the status quo. So government needed to approve our political party in order for us to receive donations, sort of campaign contributions. And it took a very long time for them to do it. Like, it was insane. It was Kafkian. Mm. And so when my business partner and old friend Xavier, the man who's the former founder of Storyfy, he called me a couple of years ago. He's like, oh, I have this project that I've been thinking about. It's called Open Collective, and I'd like you to come on board as a co-founder. For me, it was a no-brainer, because that was essentially, he was talking to me specifically about the problem that we were suffering, that we had suffered in Argentina with our political party. That is like, you know, the amount of red tape that is expected from organizations in order to start operating, it's a blocker for most of these organizations. It's a blocker mm-hmm. for so many amazing ideas to thrive and experiment and build those sandboxes. And so I just, you know, I was pregnant, 9 months pregnant, so it was like good timing from him. But mm-hmm. I just jumped at the opportunity of helping create the organizations that I thought would use liquid democracy in the future. Because the system is understands corporations, either profit or non-profit, but understands corporations as the political, as the economic and human unit, mm-hmm. or just the individual kind of freelancer or atomized. But there's something that sits in between. There is the community, the collectives, networks, mission-driven groups of people that have amazing ideas. They want to carry them out. They want to test them. They want to start building support from them. But in order to do it, they need to have a legal entity somewhere in the world. And think about open source projects. Think about any open source project that more often than not are just developers that come together online. They create great technology together, but they're from many different countries. And the idea of them building an LLC, a 501c3, a corporation, where? In the United States, in Europe, in India, right? In order to receive contributions for their work, it's a non-starter. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so that's where we sort of come in with Open Collective, kind of creating these virtual associations and sharing, mutualizing resources among different collectives and communities of people, to just help them focus on what they do best, that it's their work, instead of having to worry about legal entities and accountants and lawyers and equity or who's a president of an organization. Mm-hmm. I always say that expecting an open source project, a collective, a mission-driven network, a global social movement to have a command and control structure and to have a president is like asking who's the president of the internet. It's equally ridiculous, mm-hmm. right? Because it's so far away from how we operate.
Right.
How we are and how we structure ourselves that it's almost impossible for us to fit into these kind of squares that government expects us to fit. So Open Collective, what tries to do is to enable anyone to have a virtual association and start raising some funds and spend them in full transparency, without needing a legal entity. And if then that's what they want to do, then that's great. But, you know, it's like having one legal entity per collective is like having, I don't know, one server per content you have online. Mm-hmm. It simply doesn't make sense.
So just let me help me understand just in very clear terms. Mm-hmm. I have a number of open source projects, but it's just me. I could go off and hire lawyers if I were rich and make a nonprofit, make a 501c. Mm-hmm. But with Open Collective, I can sign up. Is there a 501c, or are we saying that this is a construct that does not require one in this context?
No, there is, and there's a host, and we call them host organizations. So essentially, uh-huh. the Open Collective platform, what it has underneath is a network of host organizations that are organizations that what they do is they virtualize their entities and host these collectives. They act as the servers. They receive the funds for these collectives. They oversee their expenses, and then they reimburse them or pay for their invoices. And because everything is done through the platform and everything is done in full transparency, it's quite safe for these host organizations to act as hosts. So Open Collective, for example, is the host organization for all the open source projects. It's called actually the Open Source Collective, and we filed already for a 501c6 that we're waiting for approval. And so if you go online and create a collective in opencollective.com/create or opensource/create that connects you directly to GitHub, then we would be receiving those funds for you. And whenever you want to spend them, you need to submit an invoice or a receipt to be reimbursed to your collective, and mm-hmm. then we cover that.
Ah, interesting. So, for example, I've gone up here to opencollective.com/webpack. Webpack's mm-hmm. a popular JavaScript tool. And, you know, I'm not logged in. I'm just an anonymous viewer. I can see here that they have approximately $100,000 annual budget. I can scroll down. I can see someone just made a $5 monthly donation. I can click on see all expenses, and I can look down here and see someone just took out $300 for documentation. Mm-hmm. So I'm literally an anonymous person, and I'm looking at their expenses. I can even see here that one of the organizers, Sean, took a Lyft ride and took $51.29 out. So there's no way to hide or smuggle or launder money in this process. It's completely transparent.
Yeah, it's that. It's transparent. Like, there's no way you can get money out of a platform if it's not via expense that is going to be public. Because for us, the associations of this generation are transparent. Every system that we've inherited is designed for corporations that compete in a scarcity-driven economy. Mm-hmm. But I think that our generation is different. We want to collaborate. We want to help one another. We share information with one another. We live and breathe open source. And so, like, our financial contributions for our collectives and the way we spend that money, they should also be transparent. And so what we set out to do was, like, a transparent ledger, a financial ledger that is transparent by design.
Interesting. Do you think, let me ask you this. Is the growth such that this has hit a nerve? This is more, it's not a GoFundMe, it's more of a Patreon for open source. Is the growth of your organization such that the internet has accepted this and says, yes, this was what we were missing all the time?
Yeah, for sure, in open source. That has been our sort of, so we are not just an open source, so we are an open source platform, but our collectives are not only from the open source community. True. We also have collectives from, like, Democracy Earth is a collective, and we have a collective for the city of Brussels, for example.
So, for the city?
Yeah, it's a city. So any initiative, citizen initiative in Brussels, it's part of the Brussels Together collective. And so what we do is we just help them mutualize all of these resources. So instead of every initiative having their own legal entity and accounting fees and, again, lawyers, we just share that amongst all the initiatives on the network. So it's much more efficient, and you can be up and running in one day.
Okay, so this means that when we go to the homepage or when we hear about Open Collective in the news, because open source is such an important part of the internet, we hear about it more. But if I want to create a collective, it could be a parent-teacher association or a robotics club for kids or a co-op for gardening.
Absolutely. We have co-ops, we have political parties, we have social movements, and we have a lot of open source projects. I think that we had a lot of pull from the open source community. I think that you're right in asking that question. It really hit a nerve there. I think that in the open source world, we still need to shift gears on the sponsor side of things. So there's clearly a need for open source projects to have some sort of level of organization and just receive funding and to receive it transparently. But what we need to work more and push more is so the other side of the equation, who's making those contributions and those donations. And obviously Webpack is like spearheading a lot of these in terms of the funding that they're getting and how they are. So what we are enabling them with Open Collective is to sell office hours to support to companies that are making contributions, for example. So a company makes a $10,000 contribution per month and has access to 10 hours of support from the Webpack core team for that month.
And all of that would be tracked?
All of that is tracked, absolutely.
Yeah, that would be amazing because I could definitely see a company saying, well, I love Webpack. I want to give $1,000 a month and I want to have that kind of, I want to have them on retainer. For example, I have legal insurance through a company called Prepaid Legal. I've never actually used it, but it's nice to know that it's available if I need their support for some reason.
Yeah. So what they do also is like they do one day workshops inside of the companies as well for like subscriptions. We're testing now a new, and I think this is super interesting. Like there's a lot of people who have very popular websites and that they want to also give back to the open source community, but they don't necessarily have funding, right, themselves. So something that we're testing now is using a network called Carbon Ads, and to place ads in those websites, and then all revenue goes straight to an open collective. So to Webpack or to the open source collective. So it's a way for online publishers that have popular networks, popular websites, to be able to contribute back to open source as well. So those kind of experiments are the kind of things that we do every day. Like we'd rack our brains just trying to think of ways how we can help open source projects find a path towards sustainability.
So what would you say to the listeners, what they can do? Can they contribute? Should they just go and try to find their favorite organization and become a sponsor? Can they sponsor Open Collective directly?
So they can do all of those things. They can sponsor the Open Source Collective directly. That would go to the umbrella organization. It would help us fund the 501c6 that we've created and we're waiting for approval, or they can find their, you know, open source project that they love and give them something, anything, $2 a month, whatever, or just a one-time $25 donation, whatever anyone can afford. Everything kind of helps. And also, we are open source, so if someone out there has an idea of how we can help collectives get revenue, you know, like this ad project that I was mentioning, or we, for example, we integrated, but we, you know, with Threadless. So if you have a collective, you can sell swag online now, and all the earnings go to your collective. So anything like that. You know, we're always looking for creative ways of helping our collectives get more funding and structure their organizations better.
This is it's definitely a very new, interesting way of thinking about governance. How do you make sure that the people who are involved are really the people? If I decided to hijack a organization and declare that I was in charge and take the money, how would that be possible?
It wouldn't. So first, because the only way of creating an open source collective is through GitHub, you actually need to be a contributor to that GitHub repo. If not, it just won't show up. You can't say, I have Webpack and not be a contributor to Webpack. So that's one thing. And then the other one is every time someone submits an expense, the community needs to approve it. And then the host organization, that in this case is the open source collective, pays for it. So the open source collective doesn't pay for any pending expenses. So it has like sort of a seal of approval from the core team of that collective before the host even thinks about paying it.
That's really smart. It does seem like this will scale. And it sounds like as you move into new kinds of organizations, that this could become the way that people support any kind of collective on the internet.
Well, and also it's super useful for organizations that have multiple local chapters that are growing horizontally. So one, for example, now is Operation Code. They are teaching veterans how to code and help them get jobs in the tech sector. And so they have their 501c3 already. And what they do is they're the host of all of their ecosystem. So if you want to start an Operation Code in Seattle or in, I don't know, San Francisco, wherever you are, they can host you. They act as your host. So you have their sort of umbrella organization. And again, you can start operating that very day and start raising funds locally, manage your budget transparently. They take a fee for the administrative costs that they incur. And then you are, boom, up and running with Operation Code. Same with Women Who Code, for example. Women Who Code is a host on Open Collective. And they have 72 cities around the world hosted on their own 501c3.
Fantastic. I noticed that because I'm in Portland, Oregon, and Women Who Code Portland uses it extensively.
Yeah, yeah. So Women Who Code Portland, they don't have a 501c3. They're just a virtual association hosted in Women Who Code.
Right, right. And I've actually done volunteer work with them, and I can submit an expense, for example, if I were going to take an Uber to go and give a talk there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. So, for example, another really cool example that we did was during the No Muslim Ban campaign last year. Early this year. We created a No Muslim Ban collective. And we started paying for the lift rides, pizzas, water, photocopies for all the lawyers that were in San Francisco airport working for free to help people that were stuck behind the as a consequence of the ban. And so we could have that up and running in 2 seconds. And the funds went to a 501c4, that's a political organization called Engine, an advocacy organization. And then we've been reimbursing lawyers for like the whole week. So lawyers, if you were working pro bono, helping people that were stuck at the airport, you would just submit your Lyft ride and we would pay for it. Or or whatever you had to eat, or the parking fees, or whatever.
Very cool. So people can learn about Open Collective at opencollective.com, and they can see Democracy Earth at democracy.earth, and they can find you on Twitter as well.
I'm Pia Mancini on Twitter and at Open Collect. It's our Twitter handle for Open Collective.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Thank you, Scott, for having me.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.